Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Terry. On today's show, host Craig Lubo interviews two candidates for the upcoming Jackson County District Attorney General election. Incumbent Jean Peters Baker, a Democrat, and her challenger, Tracy Chapel, Republican Party. Both are running unopposed in the August 4th primary election, and so it's likely they'll be the candidates in the November general election. Jean Peters Baker has served as Jackson County prosecutor since 2011. Also running for election to Jackson County prosecutor in Missouri, Chapel served as senior assistant county counselor for Jackson County, Missouri, where she provided legal advice to the county departments, including the prosecutor's office. While serving, she was responsible for the civil commitments of the mentally ill and gained an intimate understanding of the impact of mental health on the criminal justice system. In 2018, the mayor of Blue Springs named Tracy Chapel as the first African-American woman to serve as prosecutor. Under Mrs. Chapel, that office now has its first diversionary program for first-time offenders. Stay tuned. Thank you for listening to Jaws of Justice.
Joining us here on Jaws of Justice, my guest today is Jean Peters Baker, who is the current prosecuting attorney for Jackson County, and Tracy Chapel, who is the challenger, who is challenging her for election this year. Jean is with the Democratic Party, and Tracy is filed with the Republican Party. My understanding is neither of them have any opposition in the primary, so they will be opposing each other in the general election. And our assistant, Terry Wilkie, just in her introduction, included some background about both of them. So I will go straight to the interview. Welcome, Tracy and Jean.
Thank you. Thank you for having me this morning.
Okay. Let me ask Tracy, what are some of the things that you believe you have to offer that would be a change from what is being done currently in the prosecutor's office?
Well, thank you for asking that question. I think in coming into the office of the Jackson County prosecutor, the first thing that I'm going to do within the first 90 days is bring back preliminary hearings. When we do that, bring back the preliminary hearings as opposed to merely sending things to the grand jury proceedings. I think we have a level or system where we can have some transparency and accountability there. In addition to that, I think preliminary hearings offers the community and the criminal justice system the opportunity to not have prisoners sitting in jail who cannot afford bail for months or years on end. It lets you know up front whether or not that defendant actually has a viable case or not. If they do not have a viable case, then they're sent to the trial division. But if the judge determines that there's no probable cause to proceed forward, then that defendant is let loose and they're not sitting in the Jackson County Detention Center, really having us as taxpayers pay for them to sit there. So the first thing that I'm going to do is bring back the preliminary hearings. In addition to that, I really want to establish a real conviction and integrity unit. What that does, once again, it brings about a level of accountability and transparency. The conviction and integrity unit that I want to deal with, I really want to bring in people or experts, people who have dealt in the criminal justice system, individuals such as criminal justice professors, defense attorneys, internal affairs officers, and people from, definitely you have to bring people from the community along with you so that you maintain that level of transparency and accountability with the community. It is my desire to have the following cases be looked at: cases involving police officer shootings. Those would be a part of what the conviction integrity unit will look at. cases involving police officers' excessive use of force, wrongful convictions, and prosecutorial misconduct. In addition to that, I would also like to have, a third thing, I would like to have a prosecutor's office that actually reflects the community in which it prosecutes. In other words, what I'm saying is that there really needs to be diversity in that office. And the fourth thing that I like to do that is not currently being done is to work with the probate office for those individuals who are suffering from a mental illness to, I know we have a mental health court, but I like to expand that and bring in the probate court to help in getting those individuals stabilized medically so that they can actually get the help and treatment that they need and moving forward in their cases.
Okay. And you mentioned mental health court.
Yes.
Is that for all mental health cases, including civil commitments, or is that just, or do they handle just the ones that have mental health issues that have been convicted of a crime?
Currently, it is they're handling cases where there's mental illness and that person has been charged with a crime. The civil commitments are a little bit, they're a little bit different. However, when an individual is brought in to the Jackson, they're arrested and they're brought into the Jackson County Detention Center, there is an intake that's taken at that time. Per the intake, they're asking questions about, have you ever been diagnosed with a mental illness? What type of medications are you taking? Those are sort of the questions that I would like to connect with the jail on. I mean, the pieces are there. They just have to be connected. I like to connect with the jail on and say, wait a minute, this person has some mental health problems. So this person may be a candidate for mental health court because you have to treat them differently than you treat your average citizen who does not suffer from a mental illness. So you have to start changing the way that you view these individuals and how you treat their cases. But the civil commitments, those cases usually, they start off on a criminal level because, you know, some police officers have picked them up. But the county counselor's office usually will come in and ask for maybe a 21-day commitment if that person is a danger to themselves or to others. At other times, people, you know, you really don't know what they're suffering from. So you really have to dig in there and work with the jail in dealing with their intake to get that information.
All right.
Sure.
One of the things, I had the two candidates for the Wyandotte County on last week, and the current prosecutor over there has renamed the Conviction Integrity Unit with a title called Community Integrity Unit, to reflect some of those expansions, like you mentioned, with investigating police shootings and excessive force.
Sure.
Is that something you would be wanting to do, or do you think it's better to stick with the name that you have?
Well, I think the name, it's not so much telling. I think it's what you do with the unit. I mean, it could be a task force, it could be community integrity, whatever the name is, you really want to look at the outcome and what you are attempting to do. And as the next Jackson County prosecutor, because we have had such a disconnect with the community and the police department, with the community and the prosecutor's office, you have to bring the community along with you so that they have a voice in what is happening to them. Right now in the urban core, we are, and the number's probably gone up, but the last time that I checked, we were at 101 homicides. The crime violence is steadily on the rise, and really no one can figure out what to do. In addition to that, you also have these police shootings that sometimes they're being charged, sometimes they're not. There's such a level of unpredictability, and the community is at a loss because they don't understand what's going on. They don't understand the process. So I think you have to, I know you have to bring them along to actually have members from the community to sit on that board so that they have a clear understanding of what's going on. And like I said before, that expands that level of transparency and accountability for the community so that they feel that they're involved. So whatever the name is, I think the actions have to be the same. You have to bring them along.
Mm-hmm. What would you do to, in terms of the preliminary hearings, first of all, I guess the first question I should ask would be if you could just explain briefly for the listeners, tell them the difference between what happens in preliminary hearing and what happens in the grand jury proceeding.
Oh, absolutely. When an individual is charged with a crime and when the police department picks that person up and determines that there's probable cause that number one, this person committed, there's a crime that has been committed, and number two, that this individual is the person that has committed the crime, they send the case over to the prosecutor's office, who takes a look at it, and if all the elements of that crime are met, then the prosecutor files a complaint and then asks for a warrant to be issued for that person's arrest. Once that person's picked up, they have what they call an initial appearance, where they appear in court for the first time, and the judge reads them the charges against them. Thereafter, there's another court date that is issued. At that court date, that individual defendant can ask for what they call a preliminary hearing. And a preliminary hearing is really the opportunity for the defendant to say, you know, either that wasn't me or whatever defense they have, that's their opportunity to put forth that defense. At a preliminary hearing, you have a judge that's there, you have a court reporter, you have the defendant, you have the defendant's attorney, and you have the prosecutor there, as well as any witnesses that the prosecutor has to help assist them prove that this is the person, that a crime was committed, and that this was the person who committed the crime. And so it's really somewhat of a mini trial that you're putting on. And the judge makes the determination after all the evidence is submitted whether or not there's enough probable cause to move forward with the case. If there is, then the judge will send that case over to what they call a trial division, or they bind it over to a trial division, so that individual now has to go to a different judge and establish a trial date, et cetera. However, on the other hand, when usually what happens is when the defendant does ask for a preliminary hearing, the prosecutor asks the judge for a 30-day continuance to send the case directly to the grand jury. What happens at a grand jury, they usually call it a secret process because no one really knows what's going on. It's not transparent. You don't have that level, really, of accountability there. The defense attorney is not allowed to be there. The defendant is not there. There is no judge there. The only person that is there is the prosecutor, and that prosecutor is presenting evidence that this individual defendant committed a crime. There was a crime committed, and this was the individual defendant that committed the crime. So really, it's just a process where you have the prosecutor and the grand jury that's there.
All right. And I believe we have Jean on now. Is that correct?
That's right.
All right.
Thank you for having me this morning.
You're welcome.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. So I don't know if you heard the first part of my conversation with Tracy or not. One of the things that we're talking about, she said she would bring back the preliminary hearing as opposed to using the grand juries. What is your position on that?
Well, we have prelims. We call them prelims, preliminary hearings. And I brought those back when I came in office years ago. And the reason I brought them back is because I think it's a great way to vet a case early and to get evidence, to get a full vetting of a case. So I don't oppose prelims at all. In fact, as a young lawyer, that's how I really learned the value of a case. was doing preliminary hearings. And we can't force defendants through a preliminary hearing process, and so often they waive to go through the grand jury process. So all I can tell you is there was a pretty short period of time, I think it was under Mike Sanders and Jim Knatzer, during their short terms as prosecutor, that prelims were ceased. And the reason for doing that was because of jail population problems. They were trying to truncate the amount of time people sat in jail. And so that decision was made by a previous administration. But I brought them back because I just felt it's a good part of the process, and we should have them. So we do have them.
All right. And do you have any type of conviction integrity unit currently? And if so,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I sure do. I formalized that process a few years ago, and we call it our conviction review unit. Some people refer to these units as conviction integrity units. That's sort of the general title you hear around the country. It's all the same. It is a process by which members of the public can fill out a waiver, you know, fill out a paperwork online asking for the review. And so it gives a different pathway into the office than you must have, you know, enough money to hire a lawyer to get the review, or you must, you know, be a friend of the prosecutor to get a review. We didn't want it to be like that. We wanted to know whatever cases are out there that people think that we should be looking at. There are certain standards because, you know, we can't go back and retry every case that this office has ever touched. But cases that have issues, we want to look at. We want to know about them. And the next place that I'd like to go, the law does not presently support this pathway for prosecutors, but it is a pathway I am advocating for, and that is the local DA, if you will, has to have the authority to look at excessive sentences. So we do look at those right now, but our only pathway to address an excessive sentence is to go to the governor and ask the governor, you know, for clemency. And that, as you know, is pretty rare. I've actually achieved that with a governor on a case that I asked for clemency on, and it was, you know, surprising that I got it. I happened to have been reviewing that same governor for his own alleged criminal conduct during that period of time that the clemency came through. So you can see that it's, you know, that process as it stands alone is a little bit fraught with problems. So I think the local DA has got to have a pathway to address those cases as well.
All right. And one of the things, an organization, I think you, both of you, addressed this some when you did your form with the ACLU on Friday. But Kansas City Freedom Project says that your office is not addressing appropriately police abuse, excessive force cases, et cetera, police misconduct. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I'd say about that that's been a pretty public fight. I don't like to have public fights, and I'm going to explain why, and a public fight with my largest police department on that. I made a commitment with this police chief when he came on that I felt like any major disagreements or little disagreements we had, we should try and do that one-on-one, and that we should try our best to work out issues so that, you know, we were being as good of partners as we could with one another. And I made that commitment with him, and I kept it until we got to this, you know, these issues of police abuse cases. And I worked hard to try and move the needle there and move him along in a place that I felt is what the public deserved, and honestly, what this office, the Office of Prosecutor, deserves. But I couldn't get him to move there, so it required a public conversation. So we've been having that public conversation. It's uncomfortable for me, but it is also, you know, you can't take this job and expect to be comfortable. You got to do, You know, I represent the community, and I represent accountability, and sometimes that means holding police accountable for their conduct. So I would tell the KC Freedom Project to, you know, to take a look at what's already out there. We are battling, and it's a battle to receive probable cause statements, you know, on cases where police are investigating themselves. So I want you to think about that. If the alleged wrongdoing comes out of the department, and then the department chooses to investigate themselves, and then the department, you know, locks the prosecutor out of that investigative process, and then when the prosecutor asks for a probable cause statement, like they give on every other case, they say no. It really forecloses a door for the prosecutor. So now we must use that grand jury process to get our case into the system. Sometimes that's okay. Sometimes it's okay to use the grand jury system. But sometimes it's not the optimal way to do this. And what it demonstrates is a system that is very flawed when you have a police entity that can determine whether or not they want to be not just the reviewer of conduct among themselves, but also a judge and jury. And that's not okay. That's beyond the pathway that we've ever used before. And so that's why I had to make this public and have this very uncomfortable but necessary public conversation about probable cause statements.
All right. We do need to take our first break now, and we will be back in about a little over 3 minutes with Jean Peters Baker and Tracy Chapel, who are in the election opposing each other for county prosecutor in Jackson County.
Active Magazine Public Affairs Committee presents a special presentation, Black Voices, White Allies, with a special feature, The Education of a Diaper Racist. Plus, special guest, recording artist Danny Cox. That's Radioactive Magazine, Tuesday, July 21st, a special one-hour presentation, 6 to 7 p.m., right here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Are you a giving person like me? Have you ever wanted to donate something big? You know that old car in the garage that you never use? KKFI wants that. Donate to KKFI's Vehicles for Charity program and help support 90.1 FM while also finding a new home for that old car. Give us a call at 816-931-3122 and ask for a bill. Or you can just visit us at our website, kkfi.org/support. Thanks for supporting Kansas City Community Radio.
Hello, this is Joseph Jackson. Join me on Cowtown Conversations, where we will discuss matters that impact your life as a resident of the Kansas City metropolitan area. Every Thursday morning at 9 a.m., right after Democracy Now!
Now the calendar for the week of July 20th. In compliance with the latest version of Mayor Lucas' emergency order, certain business activities can resume while ensuring necessary public health measures remain in place. See the facts at kcmo.gov. Today, July 20, 6:30 to 8 p.m., July Issues to Action Kansas meeting is hosted by Moore Squared. This is an online event. Register at Moore Square on Facebook. Also Monday, July 20, 6 p.m., write postcards to candidates on behalf of Kansas City Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. On Tuesday this week, July 21, 6:30 p.m., there are phone banking opportunities in Johnson County, Kansas, Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. Other virtual monthly meetings in both Kansas and Missouri are available. Check momsdemandaction.org for information. Tuesday, July 21st, 4 to 7 p.m., Phone Banking Bingo Amendment 2, online event hosted by Moore Square. Have some fun phone banking with Moore Square to inform and identify yes voters across the Kansas City, Missouri area while playing bingo through your phone banking experience. Contact Moore Squared. On Thursday, July 23rd, 4 p.m., online event, the Women's Foundation is conducting two listening sessions for women of color moderated by Dr. Susan Wilson, UMKC. The virtual sessions will be research-based and conducted via Zoom To better understand the challenges for women of color and to implement appropriate resources for better access to boards and commissions, ultimately gaining more diversity and gender parity in civic leadership that's more representative of our communities. RSVP at womensfoundation.org or email info@womens-foundation.org to receive post-session insights and results. Friday, July 24th, 10 a.m., Moms, Sisters, Women Standing Together Against Police Brutality will be at 800 Broadway Boulevard, Kansas City, Missouri. This is a Moore Squared press conference and public action by women who have lost men to local police, particularly Kansas City Police Department and Overland Park Police Department. Also Friday, July 24th, 11 a.m., Smart Sentencing Coalition call. Get access at empowermissouri.org. Finally, Saturday, July 25th, there's a memorial and rally for Ryan Stokes, 5 to 8 p.m. at John Anderson Park, 4702 East 135th Street, Grandview, Missouri. The event is family-friendly and socially distanced. The fight for justice continues for the Stokes family. Ryan Stokes was shot and killed by Kansas City police officers. One Struggle Casey continues to maintain close ties with the family and continues to fight for justice. See Memorial Plus Rally for Ryan Stokes on Facebook. Please take care of yourselves and others. Thanks to all our listeners. Stay close to your dial and stay well. My name is Terry, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Bill Claus. Please listen next week when David Bell talks with Carl Busey.
Okay, we are back. This is Craig Lubo, and thank you for staying with us. Our continuing guest we have online, Jean Peters Baker. She is currently the Jackson County prosecutor, and she is running for re-election. And we have Tracy Chappell on the line, who is challenging her. And both will be in the general election. I believe both of them are unopposed in the primary, though. Jean, one of the items that you just heard on the calendar, and that's one of the questions I had, although I'm getting to it a little bit sooner than I was going to, was in terms of police accountability, one of the people that they're saying, that opponents are saying, that your office is not done anything to prosecute it, was the police officer involved in the killing of Ryan Stokes. A couple others was Cameron Lamb, and there's some others. What do you say about that?
Well, I could start with Ryan Stokes, and I've met with the Stokes family, and, you know, they are a really terrific family. I did believe that the law that does protect police officers, it's a law, not an option, did apply in that case. And so, though I think they are a terrific family and that that is a horrendously tragic case, I didn't believe that we could get there on that particular charge. As for Cameron Lamb, that case is pending. I did fight for that case. That's one of those I talked about regarding the probable cause statements. My prosecutorial ethics prevent me from going into details talking about the Cameron Lamb case because it is a filed case against the police officer who shot and killed him. So I cannot speak further about that because I have to vet that out, meet it out inside a courtroom, which we are going to do.
Okay. So there is a case pending, though.
Yes, sir. There sure okay. is.
All right. Tracy, do you have anything that you want to add as comments on that last part?
On the last part, I will say this. I'm really not sure what law that Ms. Baker is referring to that says the law that protects police officers. What I will say is this. Cameron Lamb was shot and killed in December of 2019. It was approximately 6 months later where the prosecutor decided to actually file charges against a police officer for the murder, and that was involuntary manslaughter, but for the murder of Cameron Lamb 6 months later. You know, when we have incidents like these, it is rare that we have seen this prosecutorial administration file any murder charges against any police officer until recently. That's all we have is the Cameron Lamb case. We also have Donnie Sanders. That's another case which involved a police officer shooting that is still out there. These cases can be handled by the prosecutor and handled expeditiously. What I am hearing is that if the police officers don't do this, then I can't do my job. The prosecutor should not pass her or delegate her authority or the ability to file charges. Don't delegate that to the police department. The police department, their job duties, and the office of the prosecutor, their job duties are separate and distinct. They are. And so what I'm continuously hearing here, what the community is hearing, is passing the buck of what the police officers didn't do so that the prosecutor's office couldn't do their job. And they could have. Even if they didn't want to submit their own probable cause statement and use their investigators in their office to do their job, take it to the grand jury. But don't wait 6 months or almost a year later to try to do something. There are families that are concerned about what has happened. There are families out there that are waiting for justice for their loved ones who have been shot. And like I said, for the last 9 years, we've not seen a police officer charged with murder outside of Cameron Lamb. Now, if I'm wrong, I'd like to know the name of another case where a police officer was charged with murder within the last 9 years.
Gene, has there been any other officers that have been charged?
Yeah, we did just finish a case against a KCPD officer for a vehicular death that he caused for killing a young man on his way to the Chiefs Stadium. So I think, you know, that case was recently finished. There also is another officer through the Sheriff's Department that has also been charged and awaiting a trial for a shooting, though it was a non-fatal shooting, of a civilian. But I want to go back to another piece that was raised by Ms. Chappell, that it took 6 months to get the Cameron Lamb probable cause. That's really twisting some facts here. I have been fighting to get that document, which I needed to present a case. Prosecutors cannot draft their own probable cause statements because I cannot attest to the work done by the police department. A judge wouldn't accept that, nor should they accept that. That is how it's done in all civilian cases, so it should be done the same way when an officer engages in wrongdoing. So though I could not get that document, the only pathway I had then was to go to the grand jury, which I did. I think we all realize that COVID did shut down the grand jury for at least 2 months. And the minute I could get back in before a grand jury, I did that. So that's part of that timeline, and I just wanted to address the actual facts around
all right.
that. Thank you.
So I want to move to the Conviction Integrity Unit. One of the people who, I don't have the timeline, but Ricky Kidd was in prison for 23 years for a murder that he did not commit. Why would it take 23 years, and what can be done? Will a Conviction Integrity Unit address those problems and speed things up? Or what else can be done to assure that when there is a wrongful conviction that they are handled more expeditiously? And I'll let each of you respond. Gene, if you want to go first.
Okay, thank you. You know, Ricky Kidd is one of the reasons I formalized the process to have a conviction integrity unit. I knew that that case, you know, it's just one of the platform cases that demonstrated for me that it wasn't enough that I could just assign those cases from time to time, that I needed to have a formalized process. And so that's what I did. Now, in Ricky Kidd's case, one of the things that I think people are surprised by is that the local prosecutor does not have the pathway into a courtroom on impaired convictions or false convictions or, you know, whatever you want to call these, whatever fits into that bucket, only in the area of DNA. So when DNA shows that someone did not commit the crime, then the local DA has the ability to file a motion and start the process to free them. The local DA simply does not have that, like in Ricky Kidd's case, which was the main crux of his case was a recantation of a witness. There was a witness, Mr. Harris, I believe his name was, who testified falsely against Mr. Kidd, and I think that is a key piece of evidence that led to his conviction by a jury back in the 1997. However, there that case went through federal court, I think in 2009 or 10, and before really a really wonderful and generous judge, Judge Scott Wright, who is now deceased. But that witness, again, Mr. Harris testified before that federal judge, and he said he was going to recant his testimony, but he didn't end up doing that under oath. And so those were all really critical pieces of information that led to Mr. Kidd still waiting, you know, for something different to happen. The Attorney General's office then, who does have the authority in this area, did pick up that case. There was a hearing, and then Mr. Harris recanted on the stand. Judge found that testimony credible. You know, for whatever reason he gave false testimony to begin with is a little bit unclear to me, but he did do that, and at that moment, then I had the authority to come in and act and dismiss his case. I did so immediately. Even though the Attorney General's office wanted to appeal that lower court decision, I told them that I did not. And so I was going to dismiss the case and did. I don't regret that decision at all. I do regret the time that it took to get to, you know, this tortured process on Mr. Kidd's case. There is also another case, I think, for everyone to be on the lookout for and watch, and it's not here in this jurisdiction, but it's in St. Louis, and it sort of demonstrates what I'm talking about. The local prosecutor in St. Louis did file a motion to help free someone that she believes is falsely convicted, and the court threw her petition out because she is not deemed to have the authority to go forward. And so we're in the middle of this litigation now to see whether or not the power of the local DA can be expanded into these areas of wrongful conviction when it doesn't hinge just on DNA.
All right. And so from what you're saying, I'm guessing that if there was some state legislation to change that you would support that change.
I sure would, but I want to be clear here. It is a Republican-led body. All state government is really led by Republicans, but for one, Nicole Galloway, who is, you know, the singular Democrat in a statewide office, but also the both chambers of the House and the Senate are extremely weighted for against Democrats. So, you know, that I don't know that I will like the legislation that I see drafted there, if it is even drafted. My guess is it probably won't be. So that will leave it potentially up to the courts to maybe find a new pathway here. But that's generally, this has to be done statutorily. And, you know, Democrats are just outnumbered in a amazing way in that building.
All right. And Tracy, when it comes to these kind of cases, is there anything that you believe you could do differently to speed up that process?
Let me start off by saying this, because I heard a lot of information. Is there now a conviction and integrity unit or a conviction review unit? When I went to actually look up the conviction review unit that is currently on the books with this administration, there is an application process, but there is also a waiver in place for the defendant to sign. That defendant has to sign a waiver, giving up all of their legal and constitutional rights in order to have their cases reviewed. This should never be. They should never give up their rights in order to have their cases reviewed. If they were wrongfully convicted, then that is what needs to be focused on, as opposed to them giving up their rights. In addition to that, when they give up their rights to have their case reviewed, if the prosecutor comes across any additional evidence or any other crime that they may or may not have committed, they're going to turn that over to the local authorities. This is in the paperwork that is in the office regarding this conviction and review unit. That really is a deterrent for any defendant, really, to really go through the process and have their cases reviewed. And I know the other night that we were on the show or the ACLU forum, the question was asked, for those who have actually gone through the unit, which is unknown, how many exonerations have there been? And out of 9 years, or however long the review unit has been in place, you've only had one. And like I stated, it really is a unit in name only and not really in action. And there's nothing there in that unit that says, oh, it has to be by DNA only. If we have questions about DNA, then we'll review that only. If it's something else, any questions about wrongful convictions dealing with any other issues, then we will not review that. That is not there at all. And so what you really have is prosecutors overseeing cases that have been, where they've overseen cases that have been wrongfully convicted in their office. And in my opinion, it is the wolf watching the chicken's coop. You need an independent unit that is going to be able to look at these cases for wrongful convictions, for police officer shootings, for police officers' excessive use of force. You need someone separate and independent to look at these cases, as opposed to the prosecutor's office looking at those cases themselves.
Okay. And as an example of that, I think it was the case involving Ricky Kidd, if I'm not mistaken, where it involved a former prosecutor who, I think,
Amy McGowan. It was Amy McGowan, okay. And Craig, I will tell you this. Amy McGowan, KC Freedom Project, is working diligently to get to and pushing for the disciplinary council to remove her license, because there are allegations, strong allegations, that she was a corrupt and unethical prosecutor. That is no different than when I mentioned I had the email that Jean Peters Baker, second in command, Dan Nelson, sent an email to homicide detectives, literally telling them not to put things in writing, because he would have to turn it over to the opposing side. That in and of itself is misconduct. It is unethical. And this is an individual who runs the office when Gene is not there. He's overseeing the entire prosecutor's office. When you have a prosecutor who thinks like that, who acts like that, they don't just, that's not their first time putting things in writing like that. That's their first time getting caught. That is not the type of prosecutor that you want in an office when you are dealing with people's lives. And like I mentioned previously, when you have an higher up like that, that is corrupt, that is unethical, it spills down into every other area in that office. I myself, because I'm a defense attorney, I myself had a case where I had another prosecutor in the office who actually
knew that a detective had already stated that my client, there was not enough probable cause to move forward with his case, this prosecutor went and got another detective and told them to write a probable cause statement and told them specifically what to write in that statement. So when I look at Dan Nelson, when I look at that prosecutor and others, that office is full of tanks. It's full of corruption, and every case in there is now compromised. So those cases, just like Amy McGowan, are very similar. Really, they're the same in nature, and those individuals do not need to be there. Jean said the other night that her second-in-command, Dan Nelson, said he did it, he should never have done it, and he will not do it again, and she believed him. How many other people have been wrongfully convicted before he could say, I'm never going to do it again? We just don't know. But you can't have that taint in your office.
Okay. One of the problems I think that exist, and I'd like both of you to comment on, is that some of the problems with holding police accountable, as well as prosecutors who engage in misconduct, is that you don't have a reasonable civil process to deal with it because of the immunity laws that exist in most states, and I don't know if it exists in Missouri, but where, for the most part, misconduct, if somebody wants to sue and hold the department liable financially, which is often one of the things that would help prevent these problems, if you hit it where it hurts by hitting their finances. Tracy, I'll let you go first this time, and then Jean, what do you think about doing away with immunity?
Well, Craig, let me start first. When we talk about holding prosecutors and police officers personally accountable, and really getting away with the immunity. When we talk about prosecutorial misconduct, that is something that's really, it's a high threshold, and that is such an, the office of the prosecutor has such an important job and task because of the power that it holds, that the office, the professional rules of Missouri ethics specifically has its own section dealing with prosecutors and trying to prevent at all measures them from committing misconduct. I think, you know, when an officer or a prosecutor acts outside the course and scope of their employment, then they should be held personally accountable and not be able to hide behind the label of immunity because they are outside of the scope of their training, outside of their duties that, you know, their duties that, they were trained to do. They should be held personally responsible. And for prosecutors, they need to lose their license. That's my opinion.
All right. And Jean, what is your opinion on that?
The issue of qualified immunity absolutely it's being looked at nationally, thank goodness, and I think it is something that that needs to be explored to see how far that door should open. It's an issue, and it's an issue for families, you know, perhaps like the Ryan Stokes family on trying to find another measure of justice. But I need to address a couple other issues that were brought up. First of all, defendants don't give up their rights. They don't give up any constitutional rights to ask the office to take a look at their case. That's just false. And I do have an individual that I brought in to look at these cases who's a former judge and had spent many, many years on the bench and before that worked as a public defender to help us look at these because my goal is on these cases is that we get it right. And no matter how late in time it is that we get it right. So we did have a case that I was able to clear because of DNA, but that's a pathway that the law allows me to use And so I used it. And so there is someone that I freed through that unit because of DNA. There are two others, however, that DNA, one was DNA, one was actually a palm print that confirmed the conviction. So it can go both directions, and I think it's important for everyone to know that.
All right. But
those defendants, even where it was confirmed that we had the right guy, didn't give up any rights. They still got to go through a process and have another review, and I was prepared for a different outcome in both of those cases.
Jean, we do need to
laid out the way they came out. And the case that Ms. Chappell is talking about, I believe, regarding another prosecutor in the office, I think is a crimes against children case, and it's a case, I believe, though, you know, I'm just having to kind of piece this together now because this has never been brought to me except when we come in forums like this.
Jean, we only have about 30 seconds left.
So we're talking about the abuse of a kid by a stepfather. So that, you know, I'm willing to have that discussion. We want to have that discussion. Let's do it. But the proper way to do something like this is to let me know that you have a problem with a case and what you think that problem is and help me try and solve it rather than use it as a political device, you know, to win an election.
Okay.
I think that's
no, no.
So, Yvonne, thank you.
I brought it to her. She has
Tracy,
email.
We're out of time.
I specifically brought it to her. I sent an email to her with the affidavit, with the deposition transcripts attached, with a long letter attached telling her how unethical her prosecutor was.
Tracy.
And what she sent me was...
We're out of time. I want to thank both of you for being here with us. And for those who just joined us, we've been talking to Jean Peters-Baker and Tracy Chappell, who are candidates for the Jackson County Prosecutor's election this year. Thank you.
The perils of reform. For years, indeed, for decades, we have seen the mirage of reform being presented by neoliberal leaders and their media tools, only to awake too late to ghoulish nightmares of shattered promises and hopes betrayed. For reform is betrayal, a devil's bargain of better days to come that only brings worse days. Today, the nation shocked by the savagery of George Floyd's curbside execution for all the world to see. Just 5 years ago, politicians claiming themselves progressive sold illusions of police body cameras as some kind of solution. But George Floyd, not to mention Rayshard Brooks, put the nail in that coffin. For it meant nothing when it came to changing cop behavior. Today's reformers in Congress promise much, but they can and will deliver little but new illusions. Reforms are but reformulations of old promises, of old wine in new bottles, of things to come that never make it. For that is the nature of capitalist society, new items to sell that end up producing new problems. New days need new ways of thinking. They need creativity. They need deep change that truly transforms not discussions, but relationships. And who will dare say that this miserable present is awash in outright oppression? Not the lie of service, but truly repression, suppression, and oppression. New oppressive systems can only bring more of the same. To quote Dr. Huey P. Newton, founder of the Black Panther Party, we want freedom, not another reform. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
sitting here in my prime. What am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD.